The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This show is brought to you by The Makery, the podcast network for makers.
You guys ready? We got no choice. Welcome to the Full Blast Podcast. I'm Jeff Fader. Before we get into it, got to take care of a little business. What do you say? Number one is Broadbeck Ironworks. Makers of the 2x72 grinder. This is a dynamite grinder, an attachment company. A grinder and attachment company, it should be, because they have so many different attachments and so many different grinders and so many different options. You can't go wrong. So if you go to BroadbeckIronworks.com and you put in the promo code KNIFETALK10, you're going to get 10% off all the grinders, attachments, parts. If you want to put it together, you can put it together. You want them to put it together, they'll put it together. Whatever you want, Broadbeck Ironworks is doing it, and they are 100% with you. Many thanks to them. They had an awesome Black Friday sale, and we are squared away with them. Terrific, terrific, terrific. BroadbeckIronworks.com. Next is Evenheat. Evenheat is the manufacturer of the finest heat treat ovens available. If you want to get yourself squared away with a good Evenheat, go to evenheat-kiln.com and check out what they have. You want to get that tap control. You want to get the solid state drive. The solid state drive is what makes sure that it's even, because it monitors the temperature with the thermocouple. And then it's just like these, it's got so many different variations in there. It's tight tolerances. So go check out what's going on with them. And if you don't want to get the tap control, you want to get the Ramp Master, go get the Ramp Master. If you don't even want to get that, go get yourself that Turn and Burn. But whatever you do, get yourself an Evenheat. And the customer service is the best. They are the best. I love those guys. BroadbeckIronworks.com. Not BroadbeckIronworks.com. Evenheat-kiln.com. My friends over at Evenheat are the best. I love those guys. Next are my friends at Nordic Edge. That's at Nordic_Edge. They are in Australia, and they make pro tools for knife makers, blacksmiths, bladesmiths, whatever you want. They make a great screw-on carbide file guide. It's outstanding. They also have other things like they have the big MERT file guide. They have broaching tools. They have beveling jigs. And if you're trying to get stocked or resupplied, it's the place to go if you're in Australia. And they teach classes. I know that Jamie Bishop, Sausage Man Forge, teaches a lot of classes out of Nordic Edge. So definitely go check out what's going on with them. I really appreciate their support, and you should too. That's Nordic_Edge or NordicEdge.com.au. Now, if you're in Canada, you gotta make sure you hustle, because Maritime Knife Supply is squared away. Maritime Knife Supply for all your belts, abrasive steels, kilns, forges, presses, heat treating ovens, all that stuff. Steels, if you want some damaged steel, all that stuff, you want your whatever you need, you're in Canada or United States, go check out Maritime Knife Supply. And Lawrence also has a scholarship with the New England School of Metalwork that is finishing up on December 1st. So if you wanted to get in on it, hurry up, because it's a great scholarship for a great class. He's very involved in the knife making community. Lawrence Lake is dynamite. I'm going to order some belts once I finish this recording, because I got to get some belts, and he makes it just as quick as anybody else, and he's a great guy. He's very involved in the knife making community, and kind of that's good enough for me. He's one of the guys who is a small business who provides a great service. I had a message from someone who got something from him and needed to make a change. He emailed Lawrence, and Lawrence got it all squared away. This guy is very involved in the knife making community, and he's very involved with the New England School of Metalwork, which is, I am trying to do everything I can to get people to go take classes at the New England School of Metalwork and the Center for Metal Arts, and he is too. So I am on board with Lawrence Lake. I'm on board on the fact that he is invested in this organization, in this craft, and I'm invested in him too. So MaritimeKnifeSupply.com, get yourself all that stuff. And if you get a 10-pack of abrasive belts, you get 10% off. I got a message from my friend, Sam Evans. Sam Evans from Trojan Horse Forge. He just hung out with another friend of ours. I can't talk about it, but I mean, at the same time, two great people. Excellent, excellent, excellent. Trojan Horse Forge makes this stable rail knife finishing vise, and this thing is insane. It comes in a bomb-proof case, and it's got... It isn't just for handles. I have never used a sanding deck better than the Trojan Horse Forge, a knife finishing vise for hand sanding my knives. The rubber gaskets, they give you tons of extra rubber, lots of nuts and different things to kind of raise up. If you have a distal taper, it supports a distal taper. You got a curve in your blade. Don't worry about that. It'll get you squared away. It is really awesome, and then now they just created this this really cool handle press attachment that allows you to press your Hidden Tang knives into the blade and holds it while it glues. It's really cool, and the T4 Sentinel oil is really great stuff too. I know my boy Will Stelter's using it. And if it's good enough for him, it's good enough for you. Definitely check out what's going on at TrojanHorseForge.com. They have payment plans available, so if you want to get, especially come the holiday season, you don't want them bills to get higher, get yourself one of them Trojan Horse Forge knife finishing vices and get on the payment plan so that no one knows. And if you put in Full Blast 10 and the promo code, you're going to get 10% off everything. So it's good enough for that. It's good enough for you. And I'm with you, so check out that. Next are my friends at Baker Forge and Tool. That's bakerforge.com. They are the makers of really, really amazing pattern welded steels and laminate steels and exotic steels and sand mize and copper mize and bronze mize. This stuff is dynamite stuff. I just finished 4 shop knives out of their Tsunami material, and it is so cool. And I don't know if it's going to come. I don't know if they'll be done by the time this drops, but it is so cool, and I love working with it, and it's really great stuff. And I tell you what, make all the jokes you want, but the gator piss that they make is fucking great. I mean, it ain't got much better than that. And I know there's a lot of jokes because of the name, but you know what? There are a lot of jokes about the name, but who else is talking about etchings, for Christ's sakes? I mean, this stuff is awesome. So go get yourself some of that gator piss, or get yourself some of that really exotic steel that is really easy to work with. It's definitely made for anybody. As long as you got a kiln, you're in good shape and it's ready to go. So definitely check out the boys over at bakerforge.com. And if you put in the promo code Full Blast, you're going to get 10% off your order. So what's so good about that? And if you're in the EU, go to my boys over at DIYEurope.eu, get yourself some of that gator piss, and stop playing. You know what I'm saying? Next are my friends at Total Boat, TotalBoat.com. They're the makers of adhesive paints, primers, polishing compounds. Boaters and DIYers, they understand that your projects need to go smoothly. So why don't you use some of that Total Boat? I am highly, highly in love with their two-part epoxy. Its stuff is great, and they also have people want to know, hey, you know, when you're, I see that you do file work, and then you have colored dye. How do you dye the color? Well, Total Boat makes dyes. So if you wanted to do, like, let's say you had some of those burls, you want to make some hybrid handle material burls, use the Total Boat. They have stuff especially for that. They have all these different types of, resins and stuff like that, two-part epoxies, and it's definitely worth it. So Keith Decent, Derek from Malden, Keith Johnson, Keith Mitchell, all my friends, Jimmy DiResta, they're all using the Total Boat, and I love it too. So go get yourself some of that Total Boat at totalboat.com/fullblast. That's a little affiliate code. They'll give you a little bit of money off, and it'll hook me up too. My friend GL Hansen and Sons just sent me a load of Hoopla. Hoopla is this awesome Gicarda. And just to let you know, Gicarda is like micarta, which is fabric and epoxy and stuff. But Gicarda is a unique composite of natural fibers and fabrics mixed with epoxy under pressure and heat. And he folds them up and then makes them look like coral. And he makes these loaves, and then he cuts the loaves, and the loaves are great for scales and stuff like that. So I'm highly in love with the Hoopla, the Colorama, Pheasant, Bofa, Ripple Cut, Tuxini, Mahi Mahi, Radium G Card. This stuff is awesome. And if you go to gcarta.bigcartel.com, get yourself some of that. And you go to, if you go to g.l.hansen, g.l Hanson and Sons. You can check out what they have. It's stuff is really, really great. And I love it. And I love the Electric Fuzz too, and all the different names and the different stuff. It is really special stuff. And I really appreciate you, GL Hanson and Sons. And last but certainly not least, I want to thank my friends at Tormek, celebrating 50 years in biz with the Black T8 sharpening, water-cooled sharpening system. I love it. I love it. I love it. I go to Tormek.com, and that's at Tormek_sharpening on IG. They're also doing a collaboration with my brother, Tomer Botner, over Florentine Kitchen Knives. They did the handle is made out of his stacked handle, and they look really cool. So definitely check out what's going on with Tormek. I use them, and I swear by them, and I have three. I love them so much. I have three, and it's made my knife sharpening just as fast as anything else. It's made my sharpening better. It's made my knife making better. The Tormek system is really great, and I would highly suggest you get that too. So with that said, happy Thanksgiving, ladies and gentlemen. I wasn't going to come in today. I actually was going to take the week off. I took the week off last week on Knife Talk. Not because my partners over at Knife Talk said that I had the squirts. I had the turkey squirts. They said Craig Lockwood, my producer, my friend, my compadre, my brother, said that I got sick from undercooked turkey, and I was sitting in the toilet all weekend. That wasn't the truth. It was very funny though, but that wasn't the case. My daughter, Lila, was coming home for Thanksgiving, and I hadn't seen her in 3 months. She's off at college in California, and we wanted her back. My wife went out to visit her for parents' weekend, and I didn't get to go, and I just like, she's got to come back, and we flew her out to New York, and she came back on a Wednesday morning, and I just could not... I couldn't even think about, I was having a hard time concentrating. I was just so excited to have her back. I'd never really thought as a parent that I would be this excited to see my daughter, my grown daughter, come back from vacation. And I swear to God, I couldn't get anything done, to the point where she came back Wednesday morning. My wife went to pick her up at the airport Wednesday morning. She took the red eye. Kind of a mistake, but you gotta learn somehow. And then I didn't come home for lunch because I knew I wouldn't be able to come back for work. So I like stayed at work and just, we left early, and I was just like, I couldn't tear myself away from her, and I just could not even think straight. I was so excited. And we had such a good time. And Thanksgiving, I always love Thanksgiving because I love the concept of it. I love the idea of being thankful and being grateful and thinking about it. And over the years, my wife and I have done things. I used to cook when I was in culinary school, I went to with my teacher. I helped him at a soup kitchen, and I like do that. I want to do more of that. And we do the turkey trot every year, and we donate turkeys and give money to the homeless. And I think it's important to be mindful and be grateful for what we have. And but at the same time, it's like, all right, I'm turkey stuffing, all this bullshit. It's not like you don't want Thanksgiving dinner in the middle of the summer, right? I mean, it's a one-time situation. Like, having turkey and all that stuff is like a one-time situation, but it's great with family. And I was just like, I never in my life thought that I would love this was my favorite Thanksgiving of all time. My daughters came back. So it was cool for me because, like, I remember coming back from college for Thanksgiving. And, Thanksgiving is this, like, in my family, it was always different because my parents were kind of doing their own thing, and I was kind of like left by the wayside, which was fine by me, frankly. But my daughter came back, and she had already made plans with some of her high school friends. And as probably some of you know, when you go to college and you come back to see your high school friends, you're all a little bit different. You're all in your different colleges, and you're all still breaking each other's balls, but you're living this life in college that's just different. And you're on your own, and maybe you're a little bit more adult, and you're responsible for your laundry, and you're responsible for making sure you get to the dinner time on time and your homework. And you have this unnatural 4 years or time of being kind of an adult, because you don't really have responsibilities. I mean, you're not paying bills. You know, you're there to work, and maybe, you know, we're there to do schoolwork. Maybe you have a part-time job, but it's like, it's a taste. It's the best taste of being an adult possible, because you don't have any real, I mean, with the exception of doing your homework, you don't really have a, you're not getting bills. There are bills coming to your house, you know, your dorm. So all of her friends were all excited to get together, and they all got together, and, you know, it was like, you know, look, let's face it. Kids experiment and they do their thing, and maybe I'm you know, allegedly there might have been some alcohol at this party, and, you know, allegedly somebody may have gotten shithoused. Not my kid. I had a really interesting conversation with my kid about it, because she's become very, like, sensitive to alcohol and drugs, and she had a lot in high school. She was witness to a lot of, you know, weeds, and then relatively normal nowadays. And she's, you know, experimented to a certain degree, and she's very wise about it all. And the funny thing is like, and I've talked to her about it, because before she went to college, I said to my wife, I said, look, I, you know, started drinking underage at probably about 15, and it probably wasn't a great idea. But at the same time, by the time I got to college, I wasn't like a disaster area. Because I think that what the hard part is, and this isn't a very, you know, this isn't a very popular topic, but kids are going to drink in college. I mean, they're going to experiment in college with other friends, and they're going to experiment. And what I didn't want is I didn't want Lila to be fucking white girl wasted. I didn't want her to be in a position where, you know, it was restrictions, restrictions, and restrictions, and then all of a sudden she shows up to college, and the next thing you know, it's just like, you know, passed out in God knows where with who knows what, maybe being in a position you don't want to be in. So when she got to be a certain age, I was really like talking to her about, like, you know, understanding that, you know, look, I know you're going to experiment, and I know that's the case, but let me just, you know, we talked about it a lot. And she did not smoke in junior high or middle school or high school. She, you know, may or may not have. Yeah, she probably experimented like after she got into college. After she got into college and her grades were all in, it was just like, I think she allowed herself. You know, we didn't say it's forbidden, but at the same time, we didn't encourage it. But at the same time, it's like, we're all like, we're not stupid. The other thing is like, she's had so many other friends who are like over the edge of like really, you know, bombing their brains out that she was very aware of it. When we went to Spain last summer for the Florentine Kitchen Knives class, they came with us, and I said to my wife, I said, look, the drinking age in Europe is 18. I'm gonna buy her a drink. And she's like, are you sure? And I'm like, look, she's gotta fucking have a drink. And through, you know, high school, I would let her taste wine. Like, my father let me taste wine. I just wanted her to kind of get, and I also didn't want to make it about, like, you know, it's about shots and doing all this stuff. I just wanted her to kind of like, I my fear was this, you know, this kid who was sheltered ends up going to college, and then it's just like a fucking disaster. My freshman roommate in college, when we showed up, I mean, I had, like, we could talk about the drink, my, you know, my underage drinking a little later, but my college roommate was a straight edger when I came in, and he was so, you know, he would proselytize, and he would talk about drinking, and he would just give it to me. And then I don't know what happened, probably like towards the three quarters of the end of the year, he went out and got drinking with some friends, and he just got obliterated, and he was unreasonable, and just turned into this sloppy drunk, and it was just like, this is not what I want at all. So I remember when we were in Spain, I'd get her you know, some fruity drink, and we were at a beach bar, and I got her this fruity drink, and it was like a daiquiri, a strawberry daiquiri, something like that, some bullshit. And I could tell that she was started to get like a little bit like contemplative, you know what I mean? Like when people start to slur a little bit, and then they're just like in their head, you know, shit's starting to, like, it's starting to activate. The alcohol is like kind of like priming them neurons and them pistons. The pistons are starting, and all of a sudden they're pontificating. You know what I mean? So she started slowly slurring and pontificating about life. And my wife, I could tell my wife was just looking at me like, oh no, this is a mistake. And I took my kid aside and I gave her what she told me is one of the best pieces of advice I've ever given her, which is I turned to her and I said to her, act like you've been here before. And she just immediately popped up, and it was just like all of a sudden, you know, she just like kind of like pulled herself together. And I said, that's all you got to do. You got to act like you've been here before. Don't be the fucking, you know, wacko. So when she got to college, her college is very strict in terms of alcohol use, and like you get caught in the dorms. I don't know. I mean, I'm shocked because when I was in college, you know, you just needed someone to get you the booze, and once you get the booze, as long as you're not outside the dorms, you're in good shape. But if you're caught in the dorms with alcohol, you can get in a lot of trouble. So she and her friends are not doing any of that. And then, you know, you're in California and like you can smoke weed anywhere. So a lot of her friends are smoking weed. But she started to notice like how it affected people, and it affected her, and it really kind of like interfered with her. It interfered with her day-to-day stuff. And I also gave her a piece of advice when she went off to college. And the only reason why I did semi-decent in college was because I felt as though I was very privileged to have a spot in this college, Kenyon College. And I felt as though if I don't do the best I can, I'm taking the spot away from someone else. And someone else who probably wanted it, needed it or wanted it more than I did. And I felt as though it's my duty to not take this position in the slot in this particular class for granted. And it really helped me kind of focus in terms of just like, at the very least, don't fuck it up. And, you know, some other kid could have taken my spot and done a better job. So I told her that. I said, you know, that was for me, that was really important. And we come from modest means, you know, we scrimped and scraved to go to college, and we're not living, and we were in the school district that we're in is like the worst in all of Westchester. This is like, it's like a disaster. So she understands that, and she kind of went with the same way. So she's doing great. And she came home. She went to this party and everyone's getting bombed. And she's just like, you know, she also wasn't feeling well. So she took some cough medicine, and she's just like, well, I'm not going to, she's like, I know that that's a mistake. Don't mix, like, you know, all of a sudden she's drinking scissor. We're not doing that. This isn't turning into like, let's get yourself some of that Robitussin and some vodka. And all of a sudden you're not doing that, especially if I'm picking her up. She knows that I would just break her balls relentlessly. She came. If I picked her up and she was bombed in the car, she ain't gonna let me have that upper hand. That's for sure. So it was interesting because the interesting part was because I was remembering when I would go home for Thanksgiving in my situation. I mean, parents are divorced. My dad was kind of on his fourth wife, trying to get his life together. They weren't really, you know, they were interested in having me over for Thanksgiving with everybody else, but it wasn't like, I didn't have a room, I didn't have a place. And then my mom was just kind of getting it together and just working and trying to get her life together and stuff like that. So there wasn't like, they weren't waiting for me with open arms, welcome, you know, I made you all this. And so when I would get home, I would drive because I had a jalopy. I had a Geo Prism. Do they even make Geos anymore? I had a Geo Prism and I would drive it back and forth from high school. From college. And I just remember being tired. And then what I would do is I'd call my friends from high school. Actually, just talked to my friend Eric and I from high school. He and I are he just got tickets for us. We're going to go see the Knicks. Every year we go see the Knicks. We go to Steakhouse. I never go to Steakhouse except for this one time a year. We go to Steakhouse and we're going to go see the Knicks. And he just got us tickets. We're going to see the Knicks and the Hawks. I cannot wait. The Knicks are playing so great this year. And, you know, it's always great to see my friend Eric. And we get a steak and we talk about our daughters are in the same boat and stuff like that. It's just kind of great. And rekindling this friendship with these high school friends is really kind of neat. It's really become one of the things that I really appreciate, that I didn't appreciate when I was younger. So I remember back in the day, you're talking 1992, 1993, that I would call my friends up and in New York during the 90s, the crazy thing is like Upper East Side, there were like certain bars. It was easy to get drink alcohol underage. There were a lot of bars that were not carding. And actually, frankly, I'll tell you a story in a sec. So you could go to any Korean markets and get whatever you wanted. They never carded. I did have a few fake IDs. I had a fake ID that was from pretending to be from NYU. And my friends, all my friends in high school, Eric and a couple other guys, we all got fake IDs and we all got our teacher's name. So I was the English teacher. He was, you know, one guy was the Spanish teacher. One guy was the, you know, history teacher. We all got the teacher's name. So, and it was NYU. And you, what you do is you would say to, you, especially if you're out of state, where they would give you an ID, like they said, well, I need a driver's license. And I would say, oh, I live in New York. What do I need a car for? And outside of New York, that worked every time. It's just like, well, why do I need, I'm a fucking NYU. I can take the subway. I'm from New York. What do I need to drive for? And that usually kind of did the ticket. But in New York, there were all these bars that would serve underage. And I remember one of the most famous ones, and I ain't going to say the name, but it was one of the most famous ones. Was on our route. We would have a route. We would go up Second Avenue. No, my bad. We would go up Lexington Avenue. No, my mistake. We'd go up Third Avenue. We'd go up Third Avenue. We'd walk up Third Avenue, pick up Eric, and then we'd pick up another guy, a couple other guys, who'd go all the way. And then we knew the different bars that wouldn't card us. So we go to this bar, that bar, pick up this guy, pick up that guy. No cell phones. We just like, you know, bing on their thing or what, bing on their doorbell or something like that, or call some pay phone. And then we go into these bars. And one of the bars on that was a bar that was famous because of the preppy murderer. I don't know if you heard of the preppy murderer. Robert Chambers was a few years older than me, a number of years older than me. He was the preppy murderer. He actually went to, that was at the time the claim to fame of the high school that I went to, because he had gotten thrown out in the sixth grade for selling coke, allegedly selling coke on a ski trip, if you can believe it or not, sixth grade. So I guess Robert Chambers, underage, takes this girl to the park. They were having apparently rough sex, and he strangled the young girl, and he ended up serving he didn't serve life. I think he got paroled a number of years ago, but that was the huge story in New York, and it was all about these Upper East Side kids and underage drinking and like this just kind of permissive craziness. And that was the thing about the late 80s and the early 90s in New York City. There were so many parents who were divorced, and they just didn't, and they're boomers, and I ain't going to talk about boomers, but you know how I feel about them. Fucking, I cannot, boomers are the worst. Let's get rid of them. You want to get rid of somebody, get rid of the boomers. They didn't know how to raise the kids. The divorce rate was through the roof. In my school, there was one kid whose parents weren't divorced. Everybody else were all divorced. All the parents were divorced. The parents were all like living in different places. We were all on our own. We were like wild animals. And that was part of it. You know, you didn't need a car in New York City. You could take the subway. You could take the bus. You could take a taxi cab. And you end up becoming friends with all these different people and different kids from different schools. And I was friends with these different kids from different girls' schools. And we almost had like you don't want to say a crew, because you just had friends that you were friendly with. You know, there were girls' schools. We had friends at this one school, and we would always see them for holidays and stuff like that. But the bottom line was, we all knew what the different underage bars were, and they didn't give a fuck. These motherfuckers didn't give a fuck. It didn't matter how young we look. It didn't matter how fruity the drinks were. You know, I'll have go to the bartender, I'll have a Bailey's and cream. I'll have a Bailey's and cream. If you don't, on the rocks. You know, I mean, these fucking kids, it's crazy that these bars allowed us in there. But at the time, especially after the preppy murderer, and it was like one of the bars that we would go to, and, you know, it was just like, it was totally crazy. But we would bump into friends from different schools all the time, and we'd bump into friends from girls' schools. We had a crew of girlfriends that they were like our sister. It was like our sister school, and we would all hang out, and we'd go to bars, or we would go to someone's house, and it was always a lot of fun. But I just remember that, especially as I got older, I remember I was talking to, I didn't realize this, but apparently, and maybe some of you listeners know this, but apparently the Wednesday before Thanksgiving is the biggest drinking night of the year. I didn't realize that until later in life. When I was growing up, I mean, any night you were back from college or in high school, frankly, was the biggest drinking night of the year. I mean, when I got to college, I didn't drink every day, but at the same time, like, I didn't get wasted. Like, I was really, like, I had a pretty good system in place. I think during high school, I threw up a couple times, but I mean, I kind of worked my way through that. And frankly, I'm really glad I had that experience only because, like, I kind of explained to Lilo the good parts and the bad parts. And then she had some sort of, like, after college and, you know, after high school, she graduated from high school, she went to a friend's house, and there may have been some weed, there may have been some alcohol, and she may have had a really bad experience. And she and I talked about it, and it was a very learning experience. I'm glad she had it in a place where she was safe. I'm glad she had it in a place where she was safe, really. You know, it was at a friend's house, and she just, like, barfing on a garbage can or something like that. And she told me about it, and we talked about it, and I told her those stories, and I'm grateful it happened. And now it's gotten her to, like, see how things happen, see the ramifications, and then learn from them. So I'm happy. I'm happy with I trust her. Like, there's a lot of friends of mine whose parents who are they're tracking their kids, and it's like, I wouldn't do that to my kid. I trust her. She's got a good head on her shoulders. She understands things. So all those years of going back for Thanksgiving, and I was thinking about all that. And then one of the weird things was, and this is, you know, maybe it's the time of the year, maybe whatever, but on this podcast and on Knife Talk, for some reason, the New York City Marathon has come up a lot. And it just passed, like, this, it's the first Sunday after Halloween or something like that. And I got reminded on Facebook that I had run the New York City Marathon 10 years ago. And one of also we were talking last week about this whole Instagram giving Fritz to knife makers and stuff like that. And I said to somebody, I was like, I only use social media for business, but that's not the case. One of the cool things about social media has been kind of catching up with high school friends and seeing a lot of my friends that I would see on, you know, from high school and from when I'd see them on coming back from Thanksgiving, I would become friendly with them again. Like, this one friend of mine, Brooke, I was friends with her for a long time before college. And then we kind of reconnected, and my summer camp friends from summer camp, we reconnected, and, you know, 25 years, 35 years later, something like that. And I will say that it is really nice because you have this opportunity to kind of glimpse into someone's life or reconnect, but without having to, like, actually, like, call them and say, you want to go get a beer? You don't have to do that. You want to get dinner? I don't have to do that. We can just, like, I can look at your pictures. You can look at my pictures. We can wave virtually. I think that's awesome. And I befriended a lot of friends of mine from those old days, and we would reminisce. And like I said, my friend Eric and I go to the Knicks game all the time, and it's really, you know, we've created these really awesome kind of things. And for me, that's been the best part of social media. The business has been the kind of the part where I'm focusing on. Like, I don't want to, like, get too hot and bothered on social media. I don't want it to ruin my day, but at the same or take my whole day up. But at the same time, you know, it is nice to kind of see friends. So back to the social media reminded me that I did the New York City Marathon. And the cool thing is like, now, next, so this, when this comes out on Friday, next week I'm turning 50. And December 6th, I'm turning 50. And I'm talking about it a lot. I'm talking about it a lot because I'm trying to, like, push myself in a position of just being accepting of it and whatever. So when I turned 40, I made this, I guess I was 39, and I was like, I got to do the New York City Marathon. And it was something that I've always wanted because I love New York. I'm such a New York fan. I love everything about New York. And I used to watch New York City Marathon. And when Hillary and I moved back to New York, we wanted to start exercising. And we joined the Roadrunners Club. The Roadrunners Club sponsors the New York City Marathon. And it's started, the New York City Marathon was with the New York City Roadrunners Club. And what they'll do is they'll offer these races, 5K, 2 mile, 5K, 10K, half marathon, all this stuff in Central Park. And they'll close off the way Central Park is, a PS. If you don't go to Central Park, if you come to New York and you go to Central Park, it's a huge mistake. So there's this outer ring, and it loops up entirely around the park. So you get the, you're basically parallel to Central Park West, and then you go up, and then you come around, and you're parallel to Fifth Avenue. And you see this, you see New York in a way that you've never really seen before, especially in like in the spring, where the trees are starting to bloom, and then you see the buildings, and then you see the people are walking their dogs, or they're running, or they're bicycling. And Central Park is a very, very special place. And I grew up, you know, going to Central Park as a child. So my wife and I decided to, after 9/11, we moved up to Westchester, and then we decided to go to the New York City Roadrunners Club, and then we would do these races. And it was fun because we'd get in the car, or we'd take the train to the city, and then we would go to do the race, and then we'd be tired, and it was always so much fun. But we loved it, and running in Central Park is so much fun, especially with other people, and it's exciting, and it's just like everything about it, running with the Roadrunners Club. And it's usually like, you know, the people who run, it's like you're talking about, like, you know, the races would be 500 people, 600 people, 1,000 people, and you felt like it wasn't just competing against people, but you felt like you were part of something, and it was nice. It was just everything about it was awesome. So we would do one race and then another race, a couple races, and it was fun for us, and it was also trying to, like, be fit and be involved in New York and stuff like that. And we found out that if you did 9 races that year, you would qualify it through the Roadrunners Club. You'd qualify to get a guaranteed spot in the New York City Marathon, but you had to qualify. You had to be able to do, I think it was like 2 or 3 half marathons, and then like 9 races altogether that were sanctioned. And then they would tally, you know, you do it online, and they would tally, and then they would say, okay, you need a couple more. And then the following year it would give you, and you need to be in, it was kind of like the ABS, frankly, because you had to be within good standings. So like you couldn't join the New York City Roadrunners this year and then do the 9 and then get in that same year. You'd have to do, it would be the second year. So we just decided at one point, we're like, well, we're just going to fucking do, I love doing the races. They give you a t-shirt. Sometimes there'd be famous people. Sometimes there'd be famous people at the starting line. There was one year where this is hilarious. It was a prostate race. There was always race. One was a Nike race. One was, they had different themes and stuff like that. One was for prostate cancer. And at the front of the goddamn, who was the person who was like, all right, are ready for, they had famous people at the starting line. It was Joan Rivers and Curtis Sliwa. Curtis Sliwa was the guy who created the Guardian Angels. He was such a fucking wacko. And now he's a radio guy. He's fucking bananas. But it was like the most New York thing. And she was, you know, Joan Rivers is saying good, you know, start, you know, and she's making, you know, jokes about assholes like that. Fucking best. I mean, that's a New York moment. You know, and then you're running up this, and the other thing is the more you run in New York City, in Central Park, the more you know where things are. For me, running, I cannot run blind. I cannot not know where I am. I need that mental. There's so much of running that's mental. Like, and part of it is like, if you know where you are, you get this unconscious understanding of where you need to be. And I just remember, if you run in Central Park and you know where the different things are, you know where the straightaways are, you know where the downhills are, you know where the uphills are, you know where you're halfway, you don't need the flags, you kind of know. And that is almost more important than the being physically fit. It's the mental understanding of, are we almost done yet? Are we close? Or you got to kind of know, where, if you're going to do especially long distance running, you kind of need to have an idea of where you are. Oh, that rock means I'm halfway. Oh, or that turn over there means that, okay, there's going to be you need it. You need it. Because otherwise, it's unless you're a fucking mental patient, it's running is so mental that it's like way more mental than it is the physical part. So I loved it. And I loved, you know, like I said, you know, all of a sudden, my wife and I are standing there. It's like, you know, Saturday morning, Sunday morning, and then there's Joan Rivers saying, "On your marks, get set, go." It's fucking awesome. So we did the whole. We were all prepared, and I said to Hillary, like, you know what? I think we should try to go for it and do the race. You know, the following year, we love doing it. We weren't like, we just love doing it. We love being, you know. And then you finish, and then they give you bagels, and you walk. You're kind of cooling down in Central Park, and then maybe we would drive and then drive home, and then we would make a whole day of it. It was awesome. And I always wanted to do New York City Marathon. So Hillary and I were going to do the New York City Marathon. And then Hillary was pregnant. We got her pregnant. You know, when people say we're pregnant, it's weird. Hillary was pregnant. I impregnated my wife. Okay. If I have to tell you that's the way it is, that's the way it is. When men and women go together and then they say we're pregnant. No. We're not pregnant. She's pregnant. And he got her pregnant. So Hillary was pregnant. Lila was on the way. And there was just no way that Hillary was due in December. So the New York City Marathon is going to be in the end of October. There is just no way, or the beginning, the first weekend, the first Sunday. It's the Sunday after Halloween. So there's just no way that Hillary's going to train. And then I had gotten in. I got a guaranteed spot. And then I just passed it up because I thought, well, if she's not running, I'm not running. Because part of it is it was like a thing we were doing together. And it's such a huge amount of time and energy spent. Like doing the New York, training for the New York City Marathon is an enormous undertaking. You have to train and it's not as hard as you think. There are actually sheets of paper. Maybe I'll post the sheet of paper, my training sheet Full Blast Podcast on Instagram, the cover page for this episode will be my training sheet that I crossed off and stuff like that. So you can find like a very easy way to do it. And basically it builds you up. Especially if you start in the spring, you do three early, you start to build up. So like during the week, you'll do three short runs, and then towards the weekend, you'll end up doing two longer runs, and then it just builds you up to the point where you start out doing 3 mile runs in the evenings on the weekdays or the weekdays, and then 7 miles in the afternoon, and it gets you up to the point where at night or towards closer to the, it goes closer to the running date, you will have be able to, by the long runs, you'll be able to run 22 miles. It's crazy. All of a sudden, if you follow the sheets and I'm not doing anything else. I'm not doing any cross training or stuff like that. I think I probably was maybe at the maximum was doing yoga or something like that. But I was running three to four nights a week. I think I had a day or two of rest, but that was weekends were long runs. So when it came down to it, I was like, well, we're not doing it. So I kind of stopped. And then at the same time, I was like, if she's going to be pregnant, why am I going to be in the Roadrunners Club? I'm not going to the city by myself. And we kind of gave it up. And then when I was turning 39, I made the decision. I kind of wanted to do it. And one of the reasons why I wanted to do it is because of my friend from high school. I mentioned her before. Her name is Brooke. Brooke went to this great girls' school in New York. We were friends for a long time. And then we kind of, she went to Brown. And we really obviously, life goes in this way where, you see people and you don't see people. Well, we reconnected on social media, on Facebook and Instagram. And she was terrific. She is a interior designer. She went to Brown and then she ended up be involved with a business with her mother, and she became very famous for the interior design work that she did with Sigourney Weaver and with the Michael J. Fox. And then she was involved recently with the Real Housewives of Bethany Frankel or something like that. But she had established herself as being a very high level interior designer. So we kind of rekindled our friendship on Facebook, and it turns out she was working with the Michael J. Fox Foundation. And part of what the Michael J. Fox Foundation does is it's very involved in the Michael J. Fox Foundation is for Parkinson's. Michael J. Fox is fighting Parkinson's. He's raising a lot of money for Parkinson's. And she said that the Michael J. Fox Foundation she was involved with the Michael J. Fox Foundation, and I'm not 100% sure how she was involved, but she would always post about being at the New York City Marathon with the Michael J. Fox Foundation. So I had sent her a message. I guess I was 39. So it must have been probably January of 2020. December, January of 2023. No, 2022, I would imagine. And then I sent her a message and I said, you know, we started chatting and remember the old days and having fun in New York City in the late 90s and stuff like that. And I said to her, you know, I was wondering, I've been running for a long time. I've always wanted to run the New York City Marathon. I was a member of the Road Runners Club. I wasn't a member of the Road Runners Club anymore, so I didn't get that, the guaranteed admission. But I do know that if you join a charitable organization and you raise money, they give you a slot. So all these different charitable organizations have slots available, and what they want you to do is they want you to raise money for them, and they'll give you the slot. So I reached out to Brooke, and I said, you know, I really want to do the New York City Marathon, and, you know, I probably did some bullshit story about, like, Parkinson's, my family. However, my uncle buddy did have Parkinson's. I think I did, you know, I was trying to figure it out, and Hillary said, yo, your buddy's got Parkinson's. I'm like, okay, you know, my uncle buddy has Parkinson's, and he was a World War II vet, and I made a whole thing about it. I was like, I'd love to be a member of the Michael J. Fox Foundation, raise money for Michael J. Fox Foundation, and then get into the New York City Marathon. So she said, oh, that's great. I will talk to a friend of mine. So she got me in touch with someone in the Michael J. Fox Foundation. And Brooke was a big deal there. She was, you know, Michael J. Fox and Tracy, his wife Tracy's interior designer. I think that she did all the interior design for the offices at the Michael J. Fox Foundation. Whatever she did, she was very well received. And when Brooke made the call, the person involved with that, you know, step two and said, you got it. You got to raise, like, I don't know, $2,000 or something like that. So I was super excited. I mean, this was like all of a sudden, I mean, I'm going to do it. Now I'm going to be in something that I've been wanting to do my whole life. And I got involved with, I got excited and I got involved with training and I found the sheet and I started doing the training. I wasn't in awesome shape to start out with. Like I was 39. I had already kind of, when I was 32, I started to change my lifestyle in terms of, like, my point was I did not want to be 60. And the doctor says, you have fucked your whole health up and you have to change everything now. That was, like, to me, that was unacceptable. I just could not have, I just did not want to make drastic changes after the fact. And a lot of my family members have done that. And there's been a lot of situations where, you know, you've already crossed the line. There's no coming back, you know. And I made a lot of changes in my life by about 30, where I really cut down on the drinking and cut down on the meat eating. I was really kind of, every meal doesn't have to be my last meal. That's one of the things I really learned, which is, like, sometimes every single thing you do, this whole concept, I'll talk about Ruizing in a minute. My friend Carl Ruiz, who passed away a number of years ago, he had this whole thing of, like, you only live once and eat and drink like this is your last day. Well, he died at, you know, he died young. He died too young. And there's like this strange concept of, like, we have to eat and drink like this is the last day on earth. And frankly, it's not really working. So, by the time I was 39, I was just like, I really would love to do this marathon. So I trained. My starting out training I'm in better shape now than when I would started training for the New York City Marathon. Like, now I've been doing Peloton for 3 years. You can check my Fader Knives on Peloton, FADER, because, you know why? It's because if you get certain milestones, they'll shout you out. And I don't want to be called Fader Knives. That would be annoying. So I wrote FADERKNIVES on Peloton. You can check my numbers. I mean, all my numbers. I'm about to hit 800 rides, and my fucking legs look great. I mean, my legs look great, and I feel great. This is the best shape I've ever been in, and I would, you know, I feel great. When I practiced for the marathon, the problem was the raising the money wasn't a big deal. Everyone was into it. You know, I raised the money, no big deal. The hard part was the amount of time and energy spent training. You're out the door on the weekend. I mean, at night, I would, you know, 3 miles isn't a big deal. 3 miles, 5 miles. I mean, you're talking, like, you know, if I'm doing a 6-minute mile or 6-minute mile, you're talking 3 miles is, like, you know, under half an hour. And, you know, a couple hours isn't a big deal. But when you start to get into 17 miles, 19 mile runs, you're away for a long time. I remember when I did 22 miles, I'm away for like 3.5, 4 hours. And it's like, it is a long time. And then you can't just run 25 miles and then just be like, all right, let's do something. Like, you're fucking dead. You're drained. And the chemicals in your fucking head are rolling around and you're acting crazy. And then you're a pill and then you're miserable. It got to the point where I was training so hard that I would come back and she'd have to cancel any kind of parties we'd go to or something. And the reason is because Jeff is miserable right now. But not miserable, he feels miserable, but he's going to be a pill. You don't want to hang out with him now because he's going to be unreasonable. I was totally like a bitch. I was such a fucking bitch when I finished these races. And it wasn't just like complaining or whining. I was just like sullen and just it's not pleasant. It takes a huge toll on you and your family when you train, because you do need, like, how much did I train? I think I trained June, July, August, September. I think I definitely did training four or five months, and 4 months of them were like serious. Like, I didn't take any days off. I was really conscious, and I lost a ton of weight, and I was like, it's a commitment. And anybody who says it's not a commitment, you know, God bless you. Those are the same type of people who don't study for tests. You want fucking natural talent to get you over the finish line, go fuck yourself. I'm a grinder. I believe in like being prepared, and I wanted to be prepared. So the race comes and goes. Well, getting there, I had to spend the night. I spent the night at a friend's house who lived in Fort Lee, and then he drove me to a bus. And then at 4 o'clock in the morning, I took the bus to Staten Island, and it was a fucking zoo. I got to the Staten Island probably 5 a.m. That's the beginning of the race. And the way that they do it is, well, number one is throughout the week you're going down to pick up your packet, and your packet includes your bib, and it includes a chip that goes on your shoe. You tie it in your shoe, and then which will go off when you go through the starting line and finish when you go off. So people can track you on the route, and then they can also tell you how you did, because everyone doesn't go at the same time. There are heats, and the heat's based on your speed, and you have to kind of be honest and be like, you know I'm doing a fucking 4 minute mile in a marathon, forget it. And I think that I put myself at like a, just to be safe, I think I did like 8.5 minute mile or something like that. And they put everybody in heats and waves, because there's like 100,000 people running this goddamn thing. It's starting out in Staten Island, going into Brooklyn, and then into Queens, and then into New York, and then into Bronx, back into New York, and then into Central Park. So I was there at 5 a.m. with the rest of the team from the Michael J. Fox Foundation. I have to find my shirt. They gave me a shirt. It's so cool. I cannot find it. I have to find my running shirt. And I remember having to, like, you're cold, and it's freezing, is middle of the, and what you don't want to do is you don't want to bring a ton of stuff. You bring a backpack, and then you throw it into a shipping container, and then that shipping container will be at the finish line. But what a lot of people do is they'll wear clothes that they never want again, and wear a ton of clothes on top of their running clothes, and then just donate it. There's like a donation bin, and then you can just get rid of it, and then it goes to donation. So there's a lot of like hanging out, because my heat didn't start until like 10:30, 11. So from 5 to like 11, I was, and the race didn't start till like, I don't know, 7, 8, or 9, something like that. And you're just pacing and stretching and you're in the cold and stuff like that. And then when we finally got to the point where we started got into the heats, and it took forever to get to the starting line, but it was amazing. The hardest part of it all was I trained on asphalt. And asphalt, I figured asphalt's just as good as everything else. I mean, you're going to be running in the city. Asphalt has a lot of give, and it makes running a lot easier. And what concrete does is it fucking just shocks your, it just shocks your, it just shoots, you just, there's nothing, it can give anything. And you just get these shoots, the shooting pain up your, it's terrible to run on. It's fucking terrible. And I'm a big dude. I was like, I think when I ran it, I was 230. And now I'm down about 215, 218, something like that. So I'm much lighter now, but I'm in better shape now to train than I was back then. So I trained on the asphalt. It felt great. But by the time I got to mile 13, I'll never forget, it was in Williamsburg. started getting these shooting pains in my knee, and I ran the whole thing, but I ended up having a lot of pain from the 13 to mile 26. And I made it through. I was 45 minutes later than I was expecting it to go, but at the same time, it was amazing. And it was amazing. And it was an incredible feat, and probably one of the most amazing things is you're running up 59th Street Bridge, and you know, all you hear is you're running on this steel grates, and you just hear everybody plodding, their feet are hitting this, and then you go over the top the peak of the 59th Street Bridge, and you start to head down, and you're going off, and then it's turning around and going up Second Avenue, and as soon as you start to head down the 59th Street Bridge, you start hearing the cheering, and the roar just erupts, and there's tons of people cheering for you along the way. And it was just, in my life, if I have to pick, you know, memorable moments, the New York City Marathon was one of them. And I just remember how miserable I was at the end because my knees were fucking shot. My doctor ended up telling me that I was too big. He knew me for a long time. He says, I hate to tell you this, but you're too big to be running long distance. And I'm like, well, fuck you. I'm doing it. I'm going to do it again at some point. So the problem was like, I would have, if I had an opportunity to do it every year, I would, but it became so much time and energy spent preparing, and you can't do it on a treadmill. Don't work. So, we passed by Fifth Avenue, and we passed by, I guess we're on the way down, where Michael J. Fox's house was, and the whole Michael J. Fox Foundation was there, and they're cheering us on, and Brooke was there, and it was super cool. I didn't get to see or meet Michael J. Fox, but it was super cool to kind of like be part of a team. The team was like, there was like 20 people on the Fox Foundation team, and that was really cool, 20 or 30, something like that. It was really cool. It was a real New York experience, frankly, and when I was all done, I was like I lost toenails, and I was like a fucking mess, and I could barely walk, and we got home, and I was a wreck. It was a wreck for days and stuff like that. But years later, now 10 years passed, and daughter's in college, and now Hillary and I are, you know, we're now, after the past 3 years, I've been doing Peloton 6 days a week. Fucking look, Fader Knives on Peloton, feel free to fucking check it to make sure I'm doing it, because I know what I'm doing, but this is the best I've ever felt. And now I know that if I train now, I mean, my wife and I just did the turkey trot. We whipped them asses. It was easy money, man. We did a 6 minute mile. I wasn't even breaking a sweat at the end of it. I could have definitely gone faster. I was goofing around. Hillary and I could have, she does the Peloton, I do the Peloton. We're ready to go. So we've been talking about it. We're both about to turn 50, 10 years later. And I was going to, Hillary and I are talking about it, and we're going to make a decision. We made the decision to not make a decision now. Cause that's the thing, is most people try to make the decision after the New York City Marathon, and they're just like, yeah, they're fired up, they're going to do it and stuff like that. And they're people, you don't have to run, but at the same time, it's just like, yeah. So I said to Hillary, I was just like, you know, this would be a great year to do it. Turning 50, great way to start 50. And she says, okay, give me until after the holidays. She wants to do it, but she said, well, how would we do it? And I can tell that she's excited because she's talking about the how you do the training, what's the best way. And she's a great runner. She runs on the weekends, especially when it's warm. She does like 7 miles, 8 miles. We can both physically do it. And for me, it's not the legs. It's more about the breathing and the mental. I am going to, if we do this, which I think there's a very good chance we're going to do it, I got to go see a guy about my knee. But other than that, I do all this stuff on spite. You know, my doctor told me I got too big to do it. I'm like, go fuck yourself, man. Jim, go fuck yourself. I'm fucking running the New York City Marathon. Just get me out there, okay? So Hillary and I made the decision, and that we're going to make a final decision, because it is a commitment. You can say you're going to do it, but if you don't do it, it's like, you know, you don't want to do the New York City Marathon and walk it. That's fool. I'm sorry, man. I'm sorry. You know, fuck that shit, man. If I want to do it this year, I want to do it feeling good. That's my goal. I'd like to get in my time that I wanted to get. And I, if my knee didn't fuck me up, I would have been there. I wanted to be 4:20, 4 hours and 20 minutes to do that. I would have been there my knee just fucking fell apart, and it was because of the concrete. I'm not because of the training. My knee fell apart, but I fucking went through it. And so we made the decision that after the holidays, we were going to, make a final decision. And Hillary said, "Well, how are we going to get in? Because we're not members of the New York City Road Runners Club again." And I said, "Well, I can write a letter to the Fox Foundation. Maybe I can reach out to Brooke." She was so thoughtful and so helpful to that. And I'm sure, wouldn't be that hard. And she said, "Well, how are we going to raise the money?" I'm like, "Don't worry about it. I'm going to squeeze these motherfuckers on the Full Blast Podcast and Knife Talk. Don't worry about that. I'm going to squeeze you motherfuckers. I don't ask for fucking anything from you sons of bitches, respectfully." If I say respectfully, that means you can't be mad at me. I don't ask for shit from you. I don't ask you to fucking post. I'd like you to, but you don't have to. I don't hockey and China. I'm not fucking giving you the bullshit Patreon. I'm fucking telling you, when the time comes and I ask for something, I'm going to expect you're going to hop too. You know what I'm saying? So I said, "Hillary, don't worry about that. These motherfuckers, these listeners of mine, they owe me. I've been giving them good content for over 5 years on this and Knife Talk. They owe me. They owe me something." I'm kidding, obviously. Half you motherfucker. Don't worry about that. So she said, "Well, what should we do?" And I'm like, "Well, I'll call up. Once you make this decision, don't call anybody yet. Don't call anybody yet. But, after, we're going to make a decision after the holidays." "Okay, no problem." So Lila comes home for the holidays and Thanksgiving, man. We're thinking about all the fun stuff we're doing, and I'm finally getting a chance to sit down and I'm looking at stuff, and I notice there's a post I hadn't seen much. I was kind of like, we're thinking about Brooke because maybe we might reach out to her again. But at the same time, it's like, I don't hawk people in Chinik. I'm not a hosser, as they say, like someone who's like always asking for shit. And all of a sudden, something came up that I wasn't expecting at all. And what I wasn't expecting was on Brooke's Instagram page, there was her obituary. There was her obituary, and it was shocking. And it was from the company that she works with, that is her company, said that they were sorry to hear of the passing of their dear friend, Brooke. And I was like, whoa. We were just talking about her. She's great. I was like, what is going on? So I read it and it was very sad because it was shocking because, now we're at the age where I just wasn't expecting it. Obviously, I wasn't expecting it, but we were talking about her. And I kind of, after reading about it, I was just like, oh, I wrote my condolences. This is so sad. I'm so sorry. I remember Brooke in high school and we used to spend time together when you're kids, you're having a good time. And I did more research. I just looked online. I just said, maybe there's something more information. And there was articles everywhere about Brooke. And I'm not going to say her last name. You could probably figure it out. It ain't hard to figure out. It was in the Post. It was in the Daily News. It was in People Magazine. It was in E! Online. Apparently, she was the interior designer for Bethany Frankel, and she was part of one of the shows. I don't watch those shows, but at the same time, it's like, any port in a storm, good for her. And what had happened was Brooke had been found in her apartment. And after, she hadn't been going to work and the people at her office were concerned. And then after 5 days, they reached out to the building management and then they opened the door and then they found her. She had died in her chair. And based on the articles, there was, advanced decomposition. She was decomposing in her chair. And to make matters worse, she had a little dog, and then the dog was, needed to eat. So dog, I don't have to say it. I don't even want to say it. But reading the stories about my friend and reading about this person who was just so lovely. You know, that's the thing about Brooke, was she was lovely. And imagining her alone in her apartment with her dog, and her dog, you know, dog was hungry. I hate to make a joke, but I mean, you understand. I mean, it's a gruesome and grisly and upsetting, and there's no real words. I know that Brooke had, she was in business with her mother. Her mother was a very exceptional interior designer. I know that she'd lost her brother. Brooke had lost her brother a number of years ago to cancer. It was very upsetting to her. And, you know, she was a very, very well-received interior designer in New York and abroad. And she had made enough of a name for herself that there was a lot of articles about it, especially local New York. She was a big wig. She was a big wig interior designer. She made a lot of, she really made a really quite a name for herself. And when they kind of said what the, you know, they said there was no foul play involved, you know, based on their investigation. But what they said was that she had died from advanced alcohol use. She was acute alcohol use was the cause. So she drank herself to death, really. Most likely, I mean, obviously not immediately, not that night, but like years and years of drinking. I remember back in high school when we used to see her at one of these bars that let us in, you know, and I remember, you know, I know that like these high society types, you know, it's, you know, you have a cocktail here, you have a drinky poo here, you know, vodka there. One of my good customers was just a very, very high functioning alcoholic. And, you know, this is now the second time I've been involved with something like this. I mean, my wife, I don't need to repeat it, but I mean, my wife's biological father was a very, very, very long suffering alcoholic. And he ended up dying by, drank himself to death. And my wife and I were called, and I was called, and I had to break the news to my, actually, this story is crazy too. So I was working for this bakery. I was on my way to an event, and I got a call. And it was the sheriff's department of this small town. And they said, "Are you Jeff Fader? Is Hillary Fader your wife, Hillary Lynn?" I said, "Yes." And I said, "I have some terrible news to tell you." You know, and she said his name, and he passed away. And the family out there were too afraid to tell Hillary, so they wanted me to break the news to her. So all of a sudden now, our daughter was a couple months old, and now I'm going to break the news to my wife that, you know, she was on maternity leave. I was going to break the news to her that her father died. So this is not news to me, but at the same time, it's just like terrible. And the Brooke thing was terrible because she was such a powerhouse. I think she was my age, so she was 48, 49. And she had really made quite a name for herself in the interior design business. And it was shocking. And the shocking part was, I mean, it was shocking. It was shocking because I'm starting to have friends who are, or dying. And my sister told me when I turned 40, 41, 42, she says, "Get ready, because now you're going to be invited to less weddings and more funerals." And I'm finding myself in that position where I'm starting to see more friends of mine who I knew pass away. I've had a few friends who have died of cancer, college friends, some high school friends, and now this is very tragic. And it was really crazy. It was the same night as my daughter went to this party, and everyone was, you know, some of these kids were getting bombed and the parents caught them, and, you know, all of a sudden it's like everyone got to go. And it was like, you know, from what I understand, from what I understand, when I heard secondhand, was the parent came in and says, is anybody drinking in here? And said, no, nobody's drinking. And then the hostess might have vomited all over the fucking dining room table. That's what I've heard. I might be wrong. Allegedly. But it's like, you know, it makes you really think. And the reason why I came, I wasn't even going to do this show, but it was like these kind of connections were just so, it was so crazy. So I'm really, really sad about Brooke. I mean, obviously, I mean, she was so helpful to me and so lovely to me and my family when I wanted to do this marathon. And, you know, it's terrible. And, you know, if we do this, I'm going to reach out to them. If we do this, and part of the reason why we do this is there's a lot involved with my wife and I in regards to doing it or not. It's not like a question of like, you got to do it. It isn't like what I want to do or don't want to do. There are like certain things that we have to, you know, there have to be in place before we make the decision. I will definitely reach out to the Fox Foundation and I'll run in on behalf of Brooke. You know, it's a very sad, tragic story, and it's a real story. And it's, I have more now, I'm finding myself having more and more friends who are finding sobriety, who are in recovery, who are looking for help. I have a lot of friends who are like, you know, the time it's, you know, it's almost like you've gone past the point of no return. So, with that said, and I never tell you motherfuckers what to do. You know, I wouldn't tell you how to live your life. A lot of you guys listening to this show are much younger than me. A lot of you guys are like, you're in your 20s, you're in your 30s, you're younger than me, which is great. I really appreciate you all. I appreciate the kind words you guys all say. But I'm going to tell you this one fucking thing. I'm going to tell you this with peace and love. You've got to prepare yourself for life. And part of that preparing for life is getting your shit together. And I hate to tell you this, but drinking all the time is not for you. And smoking weed all the time is not for you. Because what's going to happen is you're going to be put in a position of perpetual problems. And one of the things I've talked to my wife about, my wife is a nurse practitioner. She's been like a heavy duty on the floor, big time person in the, she's not a fucking behind the desk. She's in the weeds. She's with you. She's up to her back teeth in fucking humanity. She's one of the first people in our area to get COVID when it first hit. She's like, when I say she's up to her back teeth, she's up into her elbows in this humanity in healthcare. She gave me some, and she's become far more conservative in regards to, medicine, in regards to health, in regards to people. She's become a hardened person. She's been doing it a long time. She's very cavalier, not cavalier. She's very serious. And she says to me, years ago, she says, your job and my job is to do whatever it takes to stay out of the healthcare system. Stay out of the healthcare. This is someone in the healthcare system. She says, we need to do whatever it takes to stay out of the healthcare system because the United States healthcare system is a disaster. And what you can't think about going to the doctor, like taking your car to the fucking mechanic and have them fix it. You got to do some maintenance and you have to make sure whatever it takes. And we have made a real conscious decision, especially, you know, like boom, it was 30. We were kind of more conscious of what we were eating and stuff like that and the food we were serving our kid. But then after COVID, it was like lights out. I mean, before COVID, Hillary would run and now she runs because her lung capacity is much worse. And she's concerned about it. She's concerned about the long-term effects of when she got COVID and all that. And what she said to me is, you have to do whatever it takes to stay out of healthcare. And what that means is, you got to cut the bullshit. I'm not saying don't, you know, have a piece of fried chicken once in a while, but it doesn't have to be every day. You gotta work on your health. You gotta think about how you're gonna be down the line, because if you're fat right now, and you can't, it gets to the point where you get to a certain age. If you cannot get up off the ground without help, you're done, dude. You're done. So what you got to do is you got to cut this shit with the Ruizing. We're going to talk about Ruizing in a second. You got to cut the shit. You can't, the drinking every night is no good. The smoking, you got to cut it out. You got to stop eating all the bullshit all the time with the cheese and all these TikTok things where you see all these people, you know, having a fucking coming in their pants from some mac and cheese. You got to knock it off. Have a fucking salad. Do some sit-ups. Run a lap. Stay out of healthcare. And it's not, there's not, none of this, you know, magic bullet. None of it's magic bullet. Slow and steady wins the race. You cannot find this losing 20 pounds in 30 days is a bullshit. Learn these fat fads is a bullshit. You know what you're supposed to do. Don't eat the garbage and work out every day. At least walk every day. Do something and cut out the bullshit. Stop it with the sodas. Stop it with the beer. I'm going to leave you alone. But what I will say is, the last thing I'll say is, I get messages from people who are sending me messages about my friend Carl Ruiz. Carl Ruiz died a number of years ago, and his whole thing was this concept of Ruizing. What Ruizing is it's living your life like this is it. And then you're eating food like crazy, and you're drinking all the time, and you're living your life, and you're living your life. You don't want to be in a position where you don't. Ruizing didn't help him. If he was still here, life would be much more fun. If he had lived longer, things would have been good. I'm sad that he is gone, and I will not be a habitual Gavon. Gavon is a pig. Just because he did. It didn't really work very well. Ruizing is, the whole concept being of gluttony, it's, you're not helping your friends and your family. Yeah, kids. He didn't have kids. He lived his life. You can't tell him what to do, I understand. But it's not like the answer isn't, let's just party all the time. You know, I really feel like my life is better now. I've lost some weight. I haven't stepped on a scale in about a year. I don't step on scale. In the beginning, I was 250 and I went down to 220 and then I went down. It took a long time. Frankly, it took a long time. And it was a giant, it was hard work. It was a lot of long work and it was sustainable. The stuff that I do is sustainable. You want to talk about, I'm keto, I have a friend who's keto, I'm bullshit. It's all not sustainable. You got to figure it out. And I'm telling you, I just don't want to, and I'm saying this because I don't want to read stories about you. I don't want to read stories about people that I've known who are leaving people behind when it was very avoidable. And that being avoidable is an opportunity for you to create something better. I am now going to be, when this comes out on a Friday, next week I'm 50. I'm in better shape mentally because I don't drink soda anymore. I'm not drinking beer anymore. I had a glass of wine drank a couple glasses of wine at Thanksgiving. And you know what? I was like, it's enough. It's enough already. I don't need that much more. It's okay. I don't eat a pork belly. And I don't eat the fucking this. And I don't get all horned up like on the Instagram about the, you know, the ramen all the time and the fucking all of cheese and the bacon, egg, and cheese. I don't want you to take care of yourself, okay? And I want you to think about it. I want you to think about it. Here's the real thing. And I'm going to leave you alone because this isn't supposed to be a self-help thing. This isn't supposed to be a self-help thing. This is me being, you know, relatively irritated about the situation. And what I'm telling you is, you have an opportunity to live a long, healthy, and satisfying life. And you can do it without having to leave people alone. Or having to leave people with you holding the plate. You don't have to be a burden to anyone. You don't want to be involved in the healthcare system. And what you don't want to do is you just don't want to be a part of the healthcare system. You don't want to be part of the healthcare system. You know, frankly, and then I'll leave you alone. I'm going to say the reason why I did any of this is because when I was 30, I got my blood test taken. They told me that my cholesterol was a little bit higher than it should be, and they started to tell me what I had to do. And I told them, I don't want to be told what to do later in life. I don't want to be told at 60. I don't want to be told at 60 that I got to change. I have to have drastic changes in my life. When it's too late, don't do it, man. Don't do it. Just have a fucking salad. Run a little bit. Stop it with the beer all the time. It's unnecessary. You're too old for this. You're too old for this. All right, I'm going to leave you alone. I've said enough. I feel bad. You know, these kids are crazy. But poor Brooke. What happened to poor Brooke is just like, it's such a tragedy. And, you know, I just couldn't believe it. And I just like, I feel as though you could do something about it. You fucking do a sit-up or something. You know, maybe every meal doesn't have to be the greatest meal of your life. Maybe a little salad for lunch is okay. All right. I've had enough. I've had enough of telling you what to do, and you've had enough of listening. I'm sure you all fucking fucked away off. I got a great show for you next week. I don't know what's going on through the holidays. I know Finkel's going to come back at some point. Thank you for all the kind words in regards to the past episodes. And P.S., when you write, the past few episodes have been good. All of them have been good, dude. All of them have been good. So don't fucking start with the past few. All of them have been good. This podcast and Knife Talk are the number one and two maker podcasts in this godforsaken planet. And that's just the way it is, okay? So listen to me, guys. Here's what I want you to do. It's holiday time, and I don't do Patreon. What I want you to do is, you want to support this podcast, go to faderknives.com, get yourself a hat, get yourself a hoodie if we have them in size. I know the sizes are weird. Get yourself a t-shirt, get yourself a knife, go to faderknives.com. You want to support me, support this podcast, go buy something from faderknives.com, and we will see you next week, okay? Otherwise, I know I went a little bit nuts at the end. And I know some of you are just like, oh, I don't need to be told what to do, and I live my life, and I know all about. Just do me a favor. Just think about it. Take that fucking, you take that lollipop, and don't put it in your mouth. Stick it up your ass, okay? There's what I'm going to tell you. Don't take that hot dog and put it in your mouth. Shove it up your ass. It'll be better for you in the long run. It'll be better for your heart. It'll be better for everybody. I don't know if it'll be better for everybody, but it'll be good for you, okay? So when in doubt, don't put it in your mouth, shove it up your ass, okay? Shove it up your, or don't even do that. Just, you know, just put it down for a second. You don't have to have something in your mouth all the time. You know what I'm saying? And with that said, guys, we will see you next week. All right, we'll see you later. I'm out of my mind.